Hi, and thank you for inviting me. It's always great to come to somewhere new, a new place, and places, as I think we all know, inspire poetry. And so the first poem I'm going to read is about place, not necessarily a real place, but perhaps imaginary or metaphorical place. It's written in the first person, but hopefully the places in it are fairly universal. It's called Here Is. Here is where first I made a canopy of my devising, fashioned from the syrup of my breath in the stillness of the air above my bed. Here I could metamorphosize into beetle or siren, or curl like a bloated fetus when times got hard and they all buzzed like so many flies, but not for the swatting, because there were too many, and the noise was too great for the calling upon such energies held here in suspension. No, only the lumbering click of the beetle, safe in its rounded body, plastic and light, or the soft meanderings of sea-maid summonings, or the quiet waiting of the unborn, fat and steaming quietly. These, only these, could counter the swarming others, the intruders. Here is where light becomes something living, a force to be reckoned with and played with, along like a fish at the end of a line, reeled out and in and then tipped gently back after a fair fight, and not to the death for any concerned. Anglings like shafts in a prison, untrapped, bent, emerging in colours, but above all, out, yes, the positive primary, changed yet unchanged, holding its position over all else, like a substantial ghost that's not going away until light fades, and then, even then, is swimming somewhere under the surface, under the cloaking water, waiting for the right time to jump up and through and come out to play. Like girls and boys. Here is where laws of fusion rule intensely, heat not passing from colder to hotter, where work is heat, steady and smiling, and isn't hurting the jaws with the effort, steady and stately, dressed to kill at a cocktail party of hot individuals, all in red, and sipping a Bloody Mary, the first of many, listening to the ice melting under a Swizzler, and going, oh really, and yes, quite comfortable, thank you, everyone thanking everyone else over again, and the niceties raining thickly, but gently like a balm, we being gentle folk here, and doing nothing to upset the apple cart, its contents being rosy, and delicious, and not in the least precariously balanced, in symmetry. Here is where I am, where you are, where we are. Poems of place. This next poem is a villanelle, which is a form that I enjoy writing about, being a bit of a crossword fanatic. It's inspired by a place familiar to many, which suits the villanelle because it quite simply thrusts itself into one's consciousness. It's called Tipperary Uncut, and it's from this collection. Tipperary Uncut. For hunger drove the devil here, to take a bite from these sad hills, a lasting testament to fear. an ugly scar from mouth to ear, its weeping pus as running rills, for hunger drove the devil here to stalk the landscape and appear in bogs on clouds, a sight that chills, a lasting testament to fear that brings the frozen ghosts too near our screams, like cinematic stills. For hunger drove the devil here, no celluloid to move a tear, but blunt reality that wills a lasting testament to fear. And in the wind-warped trees, we hear a sound from hell as famine kills. For hunger drove the devil here, a lasting testament to fear. Cork's a lovely place, and I'm sure it's a lovely place to live, and the landscape's beautiful. But very often the place where we find ourselves belonging has very little to do with the landscape, but rather it's about finding a sense of freedom. This poem's about escaping one life and exchanging it for an altogether different life in quite another place. In this case, a sort of rented patch in a suburb of Limerick that shall remain nameless, and finding a very unexpected peace there. It's called Glade of the Boy Racers. My bee-loud glade might be the boy racers high-pitched humming around and around a Limerick suburb, but at least I have arisen and gone. The past participle gloss defies my new existence. And while here admittedly there are no bean rows, there are nonetheless compensations. My clay and wattle alternative in the middle of this grey housing estate offers its own cabinistic solace. Light filters through the lace curtains, and children still play, and cats look for company, and peace comes. A noisome peace comes rushing, bounding up the tarmac path, in through the front door, up it comes, taking the cabbage carpeted stairs two at a time, and drops like a fucking great boulder onto my desk. Its shocking revelation numbs me. It's not exactly what was expected. But this is my ministry, the last syllable echoing gladly. So much gladness. And whatever it isn't, it will do. Without a doubt, it will do just fine. Some of you will know and heard me read before that I'm quite a fan of sonnets. And the collection here is a collection of sonnets and villanelles. It's called From the Rib because a lot of them are dedicated to strong women. Women who live in an ageless, often violent, and above all an uncertain world. So one of these poems is written to women in that sort of world, and it's called Revolution. This poem was inspired by the sludge in a cup of Turkish coffee, of where people tell fortunes from what's left behind. Revolution. Does luck lie here among these cold remains of patterned coffee? Stuck deep in the sludge, where wheels of tattered tumbrils with their pains and labours wedge. There, where the women trudge their miles and push through bloody slush, their tears beguiling still, their fortune sputters up unconjured through the smiles, and now appears from west to east down ages in this cup where sages search for answers. Men will drink and throw their dice on spiky gaming boards where faded shades no longer shout or wink their warnings. Each must guard his little hoard of hopes or bread, his land, what he can earn when morning comes. The wheel slowly turns. There are, however, times when even strong women revert to feminine wiles and have to back down and admit that we can be easily won by the smallest kind of means. And this poem was inspired by an act which knocked down all my feminist things when somebody sent me some flowers, called Don't Shoot the Messenger. Then someone sent me flowers, and my disdain evaporated like the wide-eyed spray of moisture there. And so I filled my day with gestures, meekly crediting my gain by giving light, replenishing where rain had dried, attempting somehow to repay the debt to hapless go-betweens and say, you're welcome here. No more would I complain about some ritualistic waste of time or troubadours who came to lady me. I'm courting courtship now in gratitude, and from my smiling, lofty height, I'll climb way down and simper greetings when I see the flower bearer's note of platitude. Villanelle works, of course, on single rhymes and repetitions. And this is another Villanelle, which is in this book. So some events, unlike the last poem, lead us to be not smug, but realizing the fragility of life. We don't know what's round the corner, and things hang on by threads. This poem is called Fragility, if I can find it. Yes. You must observe the written sign, unfinished scribbles on the wall. Please, stay to pen the final line of bold graffiti's porcupine with pointed quills that stick and stall. You must observe the written sign, not turn away and yet decline to join the team and thus play ball. Please stay to pen the final line that joins our names, yes, yours and mine, which still shall score. But please recall, you must observe the written sign, the augury of things divine, and since it's heading for free fall, please stay to pen the final line before the crash. Let's drink our wine and raise a hope, a toast in hope for all. You must observe the written sign, please stay to pen the final line. I don't think all poetry has to be that serious, though. The other day I was driving back from Dublin, and the rain's going and the windscreen wipers are taking a rhythm, and I'm munching Werther's originals, you know, and trying to keep going and can't see, and then to add to the rhythm, there's this clunking sound in the engine, ka-chunk, and the windscreen wipers are going bang, 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 and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm breaking down, somebody's sabotaged the car, and it's beginning to take a sort of horrible rhythm, like a rat And then I'm thinking, well, now let's be positive about this. I've got to keep things sweet. And somehow, if you can keep things sweet, everything's going to be all right. And before the car finally did break down, out came a sort of rap, a sort of alternative psychology sweet rap. So it's called Sweet Rapper. And so it's sort of going like this. Bang, 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 ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. You know, bang, 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 bang. Somebody's put sugar in my tank, like having got no money in the bank breaking down. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Beat me up, you sugar daddy, because I don't care a dime or error. Just give me the beat. Sugar beat, 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 beat. Sugar beat, cane, sugar, mole, lettuce, treacle, tart. I'll prostitute myself in the name of art to keep it up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Syrup, come sprinkle sugar on my tongue so I can sing the sweetest song. He's spinning. I'm winning. Double sugar like a load of castor and pollux and other underworldly sweet soul frolics on a lute like fruit. You're a DJ hoping for a treat when your fears could sound as sweet as a party bag at Halloween full of candy. Really, that's what you make me feel, sugar meal. It's what you do to me, sweet tea. Bonbon. Enough. No more. Tis not so sweet. Enough. Stuff it in. Oh, no. Snuff it out. Ka-chung, ka-chung. Wrap it up. Two very short poems next. These poems were written about 45 years apart. they're pretty well on exactly the same theme, which is about the sort of human condition in time and place. So, first of all, I think it's called a retrospective, isn't it, when you go back in time. A young person's poem. It's called Levels, written about 45 years ago. Whisper not dark secrets of unfathomable deeps. Upreaching are the waves tipped by your desperate eyes. Kindred closer these, uniting like poles of magnetism in fellowship. They repel, glorious in a sundered bondage, the solar symbol sending upwards in a deafening arc. And a small, small voice calls from a mossy stone. And on a similar theme, a poem written much more recently, it's called Warning. Hang up your hood, masked man. Hang up the gloves. Hang up. Press stop. Remember the teacher saying, haven't you got homes to go to? That's me. That's you. Our faces coming into focus. Homeless. Some of us, I suppose we all do, we try to escape from where we find ourselves and try to find a better, more natural world, which is why there's such a popularity about nature poetry. But often this ends in disappointment. I think disappointment is a very underrated emotion. It's often the butt of jokes, and it colours our lives more than I think we care to give credit for. And we're all supposed to grow out of it. But we seldom do. This poem's about trying to escape the here and now, and finding escape a bit elusive, and perhaps ending up in the end with a bit of optimism. It's called Wild. So I took a walk on that side, as the imperative suggested, and what I found wasn't at all like they said it would be. I found amongst the barbed wire and discarded inner tubing and other rubberized detritus of wild living, things that people call natural or wild. The empty shells of beechnuts, lots of trodden leaves, sodden flat, part of the carcass of a wild thing, which I think might have been a mouse, or perhaps it was a shrew, and trails without the slug that made them, and splashes of bird muck and other evidence of things upping and buggering off. It's a past participle world you never get to when you're hurtling blithely into the future, like mirages from a more friendly environment than the one encountered heeding advice. Like chasing lights in a wet road, or ringing the fellow who's always just left, or dreaming of never arriving where you're going. Gone. Better not to reach for anything so slippery. Ah, let it wait, that other side, somewhere over, wherever. Some of us aren't ready. Couple more. This poem, I think, speaks for itself. We're inspired by about turns, by people who force an alteration in our set perspectives and bring about a change in vision. This one's called Nurture. Some people like cacti, preferring them to, say, African violets, which are difficult to maintain for all their pretty colours and softness of leaf. The prickly demands of a cactus command a reverse attention. Look at me, it shouts only occasionally from its dusty corner as it bursts incongruously into unforeseen flower. The blooms showy and unconventional, looking stuck onto the fleshy upright, not part of the whole. Don't nurture me, it snarls, unlike the wilting violet, pleading and simpering from its little round table in an orgy of self-indulgent malingering. I'm trying to let my violet go a little, give it the right conditions and see if it can get on with life and smile and bloom without interference. I'm trying to turn my attention to a cactus, which will be there, prickly and hostile and fleshily frowning, but probably not at me at all. I know what I'm supposed to do with a silly violet, but even when I do follow the prescribed routine that's supposed to help it thrive, it doesn't. It remains sick, so I am apt to reject the familiar at this stage and see if I too can stand back and do the necessary and no more. Work hard at finding gladness in a spiky, defiant appeal, and be a cactus person. Okay, this poem was written last week. The poetry, as we've seen, is often to be found in unexpected places and people and things, plants and detritus and stuff. And they become images for something greater, something personally which can be universally applied, like an apple. Now there's a symbol, you see. Okay. It's round, it's full of the ingredients of poetry and all the things that aren't there. Okay, this is called Apple Poem. It's my visual aid. An apple with vivid colour streaks shouting something out ardently against a white noise background of nonetheless a hopeful yellow. But this apple's bruised, where somebody recently dropped it, the contusion newly grey, not a dull old yellow, with the hope gone. It used to have a leaf, this apple, clinging to the stalk. Poor shrivel. But that's not there now. Leaf echo. It used to hang on an orchard tree full of other apples, populous. But it's single now. One is one and about to be consumed unit. It's all about what's not there. Imagist apple with a stomach. Elizabethan love seat, all a mix, all the ingredients, all and none. But it is a poem. I'd like to end my contribution this evening with two sonnets. A sonnet's often a tribute to somebody or something, a dedication. Many of you may know that the John Arden, the activist, playwright, pacifist, poet, passed away recently. He was inspirational to very, very many people in huge ways. And I can safely say that his influence has followed me throughout my life. From when I first appeared in his play, The Business of Good Government, in 1967, to meeting him just late last year in Kilkee. And with deep humility, this is a sonnet I wrote to him the day I heard he had died. It's called Legacy. Your voice, deliberate, distinctive, true, protested from the rally stage down years, objecting on your radical left shoe that stamped its forward foot to crush the fears that rushed to mar our joy, the life of man. And you made waves on wireless waves of words that vowed in cadences that said we can and shall defeat such civil strife. Like birds, you taught us all to fly and join the fight and Musgrave's dance. Realities of war. I first performed your wisdom from the light of 60th stage, and 45 years more allows a final meeting to ensue. Your passing gives our voices work to do. I'll end my reading with a love poem. Not long ago, I went to play my mandolin, and I found unaccountably that it had lost one of its strings. A mandolin's a lovely instrument, a love symbol if ever there was one, with its strings in pairs. So this is a love sonnet, and it's entitled Solo. My mandolin has lost a vital string. I didn't break it, simply found it so. And how it came about I cannot know, but now I'm thwarted in my fingering. The echo lesser than the song I sing. Its cadences still range from high to low, but lyrics plead to harmonize, not show accompaniment to be a paltry thing. I am that instrument without its A. The one extant is searching for its pair and lacks completeness like a street uncrossed along the zigzag route that leads away from isolated self to where I dare to find in you the string I lost.